What I'm going to talk about today, I'm not really going to go into what a lot of the popular thinking is on alternative currencies too much. I'm going to be presenting kind of a different view that's partly based on my experience and my research. And I'm going to give you a forewarning. I'm going to talk as much about state power as I am about corporate power in this context. Give this a political spin a little bit, at least for now, and then we can get more practical as we go on. I'm not getting anything I'm saying.
I think it's just to introduce yourself. I have a microphone here, so it's okay.
Okay.
Should that microphone be raised from the
floor? I could probably move it a little closer.
Anyway, lose your footing.
That's right. Is that better?
Yeah.
Maybe. We'll find out in a couple hours.
Talk loud.
So anyway, this is supposed to be a conference about corporate dominance, so I'm going to put this presentation in that context. And I can't really talk about corporate power without at the same time talking about state power, because of where I've come in my own research. Because they're really two sides of the same coin. And in my opinion, they can't really be separated, because outside of a few isolated police powers, all the authority that government has is based on the authority to regulate commerce. And this is where alternative currencies come in. And corporations, all corporations, even nonprofits, are actual commercial entities. That's their legal status, and that's important to keep in mind. Technically, even government is a corporation. It's a municipal public corporation. And I'm kind of touching on legal issues, and if it sounds like grief, don't worry too much, and you can ask me questions about it. But I want to touch on this briefly. So the political solutions that we hear a lot about to address the corporate dominance issue are valid precisely because government has the authority to regulate commerce, and corporations are, by default, commerce. So this is an appropriate approach to take. But I'd like to take a step back from that and take it in a slightly different direction, because in this light, community-based alternative currencies in particular present a unique opportunity, because on the one hand, and as far as I know, this has been completely ignored to date. I don't see anything about this in the literature. On the one hand, community currencies bypass the banking system, of course, and banks are, let's face it, the mother of all corporations, in more ways than one. But there's another side to it, which is that community currencies, typically the activity that goes on within systems like that is non-commercial. That is, it's not for the purpose of getting profit. There's no profit intent connected to it. And what that means is that in the process of bypassing the banking system, there's also the potential to bypass government. And this is what community is really supposed to be all about, is not relying on either one. So there are economic, cultural, and legal dimensions to how we've kind of come to this point in history where we now stand and why this conference is going on. And a lot of the economic aspects have been addressed pretty substantially already. We know about the fact that as the economy becomes more and more global, we as individuals become more and more isolated. And in that process, communities get torn apart because capital in a local economy gets siphoned off to corporate headquarters, multinationals move in. This is the Walmart syndrome. And then in our personal lives, we've seen more and more of this phenomena of everyday life being just this dance from one corporation to another. with very little time spent relating to individuals, especially on an economic level. There's a lost art here. And this is what an alternative currency can bring back. One important element in this process has to do with the nature of employment that doesn't get discussed very often. And we know about employment as a means of exploitation. To put a slightly different twist on it, employment, ultimately and legally, is a master-servant relationship. And it's important to keep this in mind, and to keep in mind that all the labor legislation in the world and all the labor unions in the world, as important as they are, don't change this fundamental relationship. What changes it is coming together on a different basis from the beginning. And then from employment, we have consumerism, which is really the flip side of it. Consumerism, which is another way of relating to a corporation, usually, is where we get our reward for putting in a full day of servitude. Our reward is that we get to get served now. So we play the other side. It's master servant all over again. And never do we get a chance to just come together as equals and make an economic transaction and negotiate just on the basis of faith and what we've got there. There's always some kind of interface. Another aspect of this, with both employment and consumerism, is the culture of what's called limited liability. Employees cannot be held accountable for what they do when they're working. That has its roots in its status as servitude. Consumers, of course, are never responsible for anything. And because of a culture where there's no real liability and no accountability and no responsibility, there's no trustworthiness built into it. Anything that involves risk is immediately insured in our society. And because there's no trustworthiness, there's no trust between individuals. And if there's no trust, how can there be community? Because that's really the basis of it. If that wasn't bad enough, to add insult to injury, there's been a parallel trend to the corporate dominance, which is what I call presumed commerce. And this is where government comes in, and parallel to this process starts reclassifying private activity, where we find more and more that things that would never have been considered commerce are being licensed and regulated, and there's no meaningful opposition to this process in many cases. In many cases, this is justified, but the fundamental authority has been forgotten. It seems sometimes that one of the best kept secrets in America is that this country was founded by anarchists who really didn't believe that government should have any authority over our private activities, and certainly didn't grant that authority. What's that? Picture anything that you might hold a license for. Are you married? Okay. If you were, chances are you'd have a marriage license. Why? A license is a technical legal term. It means permission to do something that would otherwise be unlawful. And because there's such a thing as a marriage license, there's such a thing as child and family services. The most serious example is labor, employment. Our labor, our means of survival, is considered commerce. That's why we can be taxed for it. Um, I feel pressed to point out, this is a little bit of a technicality, but something in the language of what has come out of this conference. Technically, corporations have always been considered persons. This goes back for centuries. The term person is a legal term. It can indicate a human individual, or it can indicate a corporation or even a state. The distinction was between natural persons and artificial persons. It's true that artificial persons, corporations, have been in the last 100 years, 150 years, especially since the Civil War, granted the rights that had always been reserved for natural persons. But the fundamental nature of corporations hasn't really changed all that much. It's just that we've given them a lot more leeway. On the other hand, what has really been transformed is us. We no longer have the same status, in that we have been transformed into corporations. It's kind of the other way around. And if you don't believe me, consider this. How many people in this room have a social security number? Guess what? You've got a corporate ID number. That's why you can't fill out an income tax form without a social security number, because the income tax always has been, still is, a corporate tax. It's a tax on corporations. So you have to be defined as a corporation before that tax can be assessed on you and your activity. Just to the side. It's interesting. If somebody that was around at the time of the American Revolution could be transported to our century and placed in front of a patriot that talked about their rights as a taxpaying citizen, I'm really afraid that our guest from the past would die horribly of laughter, because this is so alien to the conception that this nation was founded on. Now, if you took somebody from the Roman Empire and did the same thing with them, they would say, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. That was the understanding. Or most European countries at the time of the revolution as well. But there was an understanding that the power to tax is the power to destroy. And you can only tax something that you have authority over and that you've created. And that was corporations. And it's interesting to note that the income tax as we have it legally came into existence about the same time as the Federal Reserve System. So there's an inevitable result of this process of licensing and regulation of private activity, which is the backlash, this cry for less government. And it's completely justified, because government is going places where they really have no business. And they're not doing the things that are their business, because the distinction has been lost. What we've got now with this arrangement is a dichotomy between capitalist oppression on the one side and government oppression on the other side. This is kind of the classical left-right struggle in a lot of ways. And the only way to escape from that is to establish a third point of reference, which is really the original point of reference. The only way to permanently free ourselves from either of these forms of oppression is to simultaneously extract yourself from both. This does not require that we cut all ties with commerce or with corporations, and that are boycotts, but that serves a different function. But it does require that we know when we're in it and when we're not, and recognize the significance of that. And the process of making an economic exchange outside of the corporate system and outside of the commercial system gives us an opportunity to rediscover what the basis of our civilization really is, that it's about trust and honesty. And that these systems that are constantly mediating everything are not a requirement. And as for politics, I would have to say that it's only from this third point of reference that we can really see what our true interests are and act from there. And by operating outside of commerce, 90% of all legislation that's on the books doesn't apply to us. We fall into common law is what happens. It's essentially constitutional law. And that's the way it was meant to be. And I would say that that's got to be the first step in regaining independence from corporations. The second step has got to be taking possession of our labor. This is something that alternative currencies can do in a unique way. If you look at all, try to think about all the ways that our labor is taken from us. I mean, first, at the source is the wages that we get. Well, yeah, we know this. And then after that, there's taxation, which I've touched on. And then after that, there's what's called usury. Most of us are paying it whether we know it or not. Interest on some debt somewhere. If we're paying rent, we're paying somebody's mortgage. Most of us have credit cards now, or are constantly fighting them off if we don't. And then there's inflation, which is built into the banking system. And inflation means that not only does any money that we have constantly lose value, but the wages that we're getting are constantly losing value as well. And let's face it, cost of living increases and wages never quite catch up, or they're always playing catch up. And there's a reason for that. And then the third step in taking back independence, I would say, would be recapturing community. And this is another thing that alternative currencies are in a unique position to do. An economic exchange is unlike any other kind of community building activity, because no matter how many potlucks you go to with somebody, no matter how many parties you go to with somebody, there are certain things you never learn about. You never really learn what you can trust them for. And one economic exchange brings all this stuff out. Real quick. And something I point out sometimes is that trust is not a black and white thing. There are certain types of trust. Some people can be trusted always to be honest. Some people can always be trusted to do a good job at whatever their skill is. Once you know what that is, then the trust is there. Community follows immediately. You don't even have to think about it. But having an alternative currency in place also provides an environment. An environment that develops a local economy, wealth that can't be extracted, it stays in that local community. It's also an ideal environment for starting new projects that can become commercial interests, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's essential. Because it's not the kind of competitive rough and tumble system that getting started in a commercial economy is like. It's also the way to discover what the resources are that are available in a community. That comes out right away, and it's amazing when it does. I mean, the resources that are in the average neighborhood that never get seen would just live for you if you were able to see it, really. It provides an environment where labor-owned and consumer-owned co-ops form and survive. These organizations have a real hard time in the commercial environment because everything is cut to the bottom line. And it's also an opportunity, in fact, a need to practice self-government both at the community level and at the individual level, because this is all about personal accountability. And finally, in the course of this, a community can discover that it's possible to survive an economic breakdown if it were to happen. And it's really only with this knowledge that people can find the courage to effect radical change in the system. You have to have this understanding that you could survive the change and take risks. And that's most of what I have to say at the beginning. The requirement for creating a system like this, essentially there needs to be an initial community. It's my opinion that 70 or 80 people is a minimum to start, to have a certain amount of self-sufficiency in terms of being able to meet a certain set of basic needs that come up. And it does require a few people that are willing to step forward and provide a little leadership and learn the basic skills that are required. And on that note, I'd like to open it up for questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you said there's those 3 points to take back to the system. And you didn't really quite say sovereignty, though, declaring our personal sovereignty. Would that be part of where you're, a healthy part of the approach?
I think it's an important concept to understand. I think it's part of it, yeah. You could say the first step is reclaiming our sovereignty. But I don't mean that in quite the same way that some people do. I don't think that it has to be a black and white off-on issue. I consider commerce and corporations and government authority to be necessary. I consider them necessary evils, but I consider them necessary. There are people who completely extract themselves from that system and become sovereign individuals. But that's not a road that most of us can take. It's just not practical yet.
I don't think you have to think you can be sovereign, and then from that sovereign, that third point of view you're talking about, choose then to participate in government or corporations.
In many ways you can, yeah. But most of our interactions with government and corporations end up putting us into implied contracts. And those contracts place us under the jurisdiction of commerce. That's the problem.
Understood, but if you go into the contract knowing your common law rights, mm-hmm. it's a very different framework for being in prison.
Right. Yeah, as I said, you have to know when you're in it and when you're not. That's the main point. Other questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, when you say like this,
it's real broad. Yeah. Talking about, or beginning to explore this thing. Uh-huh. Are there any successful communities out there?
Yes, there are. There are, I would guess, probably a couple of hundred alternative currency systems that are now active around the country. Many of them are very small. Some of them are larger, and we hear about them. They're the time dollar system, Ithaca Hour. Some of you might have heard of that. Here locally, we've got one called Cascadia Hours. Those are the, there are different types of systems, and I should probably outline what some of them are. There are systems that are based on what's called script, which is just a paper currency that gets printed and circulated. And then there are other systems that are based on accounts, where there's actually a bookkeeping system built in. And it makes a big difference which way you go. It makes a difference depending on what your aim is. A script system or a paper currency system is very easy to set up. It doesn't require as much work and as much maintenance. But there's also a lot more potential for it to go out of control and for you to lose track of where it's going. There's also a difference in the scale of alternative currency systems. There are some that are very, very focused. The one that I started in Northeast Portland covers about a 5-block radius. It's very focused. There are others that are much more spread out. The Cascadia system is regional. It's from Eugene to Vancouver. They're actually running into trouble, from what I've heard now, because they're crossing the state line. That puts them into international commerce or interstate commerce, which is federal.
Does the government come after them?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. There have been a lot of approaches taken to this. There are, of course, a lot of business barter systems, which, they're by default commercial. It's my impression that most barter systems that are community oriented, kind of, they recognize that you have to be going into something with the intent to make a profit for it to be taxable. Many of them recognize that, but haven't taken really a step beyond that of making the whole system non-commercial. But I don't think I really addressed the question. What was it?
I was just trying to get a sense of where the models, the people are doing this, how are they doing that? Are they disengaging? How are they going to be disengaged from the vertical commercial system?
Yeah.
She asked if the government is coming out.
Oh, yeah. There are some systems. Thanks.
I'm awake.
Somebody is. There are some systems that have actually gone through the courts and taken the approach that an exchange in this system is actually a mutual gifting. So we're not really making an exchange, it's just I'm giving a gift and they're giving a gift. And the courts have actually said, okay, in that case, it's not taxable. Personally, I don't advocate that approach, because it means that any agreement you make in the system can't be enforced. But it is an approach that has worked. So it's one way of taking yourself outside the tax system. There are systems in history that have been shut down by governments. There's no doubt about it. It has happened in this country and in other countries. Yeah.
I guess what I'm interested in grassroots, how to. I wondered if maybe you spent some time on literally how you started and what you're doing, and if you've got any handouts. Let's see, my experience has been I don't live in a real dense neighborhood like in the southeast of Portland or something where it's conducive to it, but things that I've tried cooperatively, I was spending all my time educating, and quick example, I put out in a very widespread garden newsletter and some other things about trying to start a garden tool co-op. I did not get one call from someone who even knew what I was talking about. I spent all my time on the phone just talking about cooperative types of situations like this and sharing. I'm semi-articulate. I felt like after the conversation was over, this person still didn't understand. And I got a lot of calls about when I after explained, I said, oh, that sounds good. I'll use this for my rubber tilling business. And that kind of thing. No. So, you know, I got discouraged. I don't stay discouraged. And I'm ready in a lot of different areas to start real small, like you did. But I did something that wasn't working. I want to know, to start over again, something, what works and how you did it.
Yeah. There are two things I want to say about that. One is, actually, most of the successful alternative currency systems are in rural areas or relatively isolated communities, because there tends to be more community to begin with. There are actually relatively few that have succeeded in an urban setting. That's one thing I'm trying to change. But the other thing, what your question has set me up for, is that I'm going to be offering another workshop that's going to be separate from the conference, and it's going to be in about a week and a half on the 3rd, actually. And I've got some flyers for it here. It's going to be held at the library downtown. So anyone here who's interested is welcome to take one of these flyers and show up. It's going to be free. It's a Thursday evening, if you can make that. If there's a schedule conflict, then contact me. I'll probably be setting up another one sooner or later. So, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Interested to see what how you feel things like world, globalization of economies will affect the efforts in local currencies, and whether things like world trade may feel really threatened by localized currencies if they become more established, and kind of going back to government attacks on that, whether if you see in the future the potential with globalization form of more government attacks on localized.
Well, the main effect that I see of the globalization on local currencies is it's making them more necessary. There's no doubt about it. I haven't really seen strong evidence yet that the global currency systems have felt threatened by local currencies, but I suspect that's because they haven't really seen any impact on global commerce, and maybe they never will. You know, it's entirely possible that they'll just always be two different worlds. I think that's entirely probable. On the other hand, it's hard to say if there's a breakdown in the global system, then anything could happen.
But it just seems to me that since, you know, one of the beautiful things about local currencies is to exclude the exchange of money out of the community, that would, you know, by the standards that the WTO and GATT and all of those things kind of dictate, that would be discriminatory against larger corporations that want to take money out of the communities.
Well, this has to do with treaties that are being signed between governments. And if we place ourselves in a position where we're outside of the legislation, then we're also outside of those treaties. Or by all rights, we should be. There will probably be some gray areas and some debates and maybe even skirmishes. But that's the fundamental point, is that we're bypassing the whole system.
You have to go through the legal establishment of the currency system in order to bypass it.
My approach is that we have to avoid legal establishments altogether. My system is not incorporated. It's not registered with any state or local body. It's a common law association. We exist on the basis of the First Amendment, the right of association. Period. That's it. And that's really all that's required. Yeah,
in light of the same way in the common law association, can you describe possibly some exchanges that you and your fellow five options do, or what types of things you exchange, kind of a day in the life of what you
sure.
Yeah, to give a few examples, there are... My approach has been to focus on services first instead of items. And that tends to be, first of all, what's available. People can often spare time easier than they can spare their property. And also, exchanging services really brings up all the issues that come up in an exchange much more quickly and more completely than trading stuff does, because it's your labor, it's your time, you know, it starts to get personal real fast. So examples of services that get exchanged really easily, things like haircuts, mowing lawns, things like that get exchanged all the time. There was an example recently. We actually had our first car sold in the system, technically. And there's kind of an informal arrangement in exchange for the sale of the car. There's going to be ongoing work done on a different car. It's being sold to someone who's a mechanic. As an example of some economic situations where some formality is really called for, an example is housing. It's perfectly possible to use an alternative currency system for housing. And it's important to have at least some kind of accounting system there. And that's really all that a currency system is. It's an accounting system. Because when it's an ongoing transaction like that, and one that's so close, it's real easy to lose yourself in that. And it's real hard to keep perspective on what value has been traded. And if you're trading labor for housing, which is very common, these arrangements typically don't last more than a few months unless there's some kind of mediation there. Because, you know, one person's living there and they're just there, and that doesn't seem like all that much. And the other person is getting labor, but it never quite seems like enough. Or maybe it seems like too much. If you can make a payment every time a job is done and then make a payment for rent, basically, then all those questions get resolved. And then it works fine. Yeah.
I was just going to give a good example. I joined a program called Berkeley Bread, and it's based in Berkeley, California, and it covers like some of the suburbs in San Francisco. So basically, the way this works is that every bread hour is valued at $12 for things for a fair living wage. And when you first sign up, they give you like 4 hours free. And they ask you, they have like a directory, and so you give them three things that you request and three things that you offer, and then they publish that. And so essentially, what I do is I offer like house cleaning and yard work, and I request a massage and dental care. So you can do exchanges, or you can do payment, or you can do a combination of both. So my first exchange was a few weeks ago, and I exchanged, I got a massage from an acupressurist, in exchange for $21 in bread and $15 in labor. So it was like, but we didn't negotiate. I wanted to be fair because I thought I was going to be the better part of the bargain. And I was like, well, I'm going to do a massage. I was like, I'm be fair about this. And she was feeling the same exact way, actually. She had a yard full of like weed, essentially. So, you know, we were really tenuous with each other. It brought out all the issues that bought the exchange. And
yeah.
She both walked away from where they did. It's actually going to be a, it's going to be a long-term relationship now because she has, she's actually a problem. She has a lot of people to have a screen back.
That's a great example, yeah. That's an idyllic example. It's really this, what you mentioned about the negotiation is really significant because when I say most exchanges in a community currency system are non-commercial, that's true, but it's not really recognized overtly very often. And I try to get people to actually think about that fact, that when you're going into an exchange in this context, you're not going into it for profit, which means you're going into it for some other reason. And that's to make a fair exchange. And that if people can actually get that overtly in their mind, that the purpose of this is to make a fair exchange, then the whole flavor of the negotiation starts to change. Because you're no longer haggling about a price. You're just trying to figure out what happened, what it was worth.
It seems like that basic, that $12 an hour that you gave me something, it seems like that needs to be identified, that needs to be agreed upon by people. Because in exchange, I do massage and want to barter with people, and when I go into that interaction with them, I have to decide whether they are talking about their top possible dollar, in which case I'll say, okay, well, I'm bartering $40 worth, but if you want to go to the bottom baseline and say, well, I'm grateful, what's our time worth? Okay, let's go for that.
Yeah.
It really needs to be established. I mean, what course, in my opinion, establishing that baseline living wage and going from there.
Yeah, it does.
And $12 an hour. Actually, most systems that I've looked at actually use $10 per hour, so that's kind of interesting. Maybe the cost of living is a little higher per foot. But there's usually some kind of standard like that. That's extremely common. There are some systems that have for a while taken the approach that all labor should have the same value, but usually they end up drifting from that after a while. And I don't make any attempt to do that. But I have taken the position that members should consider the currency to have the value of, that we're using that as a standard. $10 an hour is kind of the standard, and then that reflects in the currency. But it's important that it's not like people are agreeing to a rule, that there has to be, people have to be able to negotiate according to their own conscience and according to what they see happening in the system, because otherwise, how are you going to know if your currency is losing value, if everyone, you know, if there's price fixing? And you need to get feedback like that. Because you are constantly issuing new currency, and there has to be some rational basis for doing that. Because an economy is something that is constantly expanding, growing. If it's not, then it's most likely dying. Economies don't just sit at a certain level and go on like a machine. They're living systems. Yeah?
You Are you aware of the different systems here in the Portland area? And is there a resource of them? And do you know about that? Can you help a little bit about how they do?
I'm only aware of a couple. I mentioned the Cascadia Hour system, and I don't have a number for them, but they can be contacted through Community Connection, and sometimes I see them in other papers. And that's the regional system. I do sometimes hear about other neighborhood level systems. But I don't really have any detailed information about them or whether they're still around. So, as far as I can tell, we need to start creating them. And that's what my coming workshop is about.
Can you explain why economists always go?
She asked why an economy always has to grow. And it's a good question. That's not necessarily, I know we hear about sustainable economic development, and it gets a little confusing. In an economy that's producing things, and if you're gonna sustain any kind of reasonable population level, you've got to be constantly producing things. These things that are being produced are coming into circulation, and they're being traded, and they're being added to the economy. As that's happening, there needs to be more currency added to the system to compensate for that, because the more stuff getting traded, the more currency is needed to trade it. That's one side of it. Another side of it is that there's a constant development of infrastructure. Light rail, convention center, what have you. Those things are always being built, and that adds value to the economy. Essentially, an economy is something that is constantly transforming itself. That's its nature. It's not like government, it's not like culture, quite in the same way. Culture does it in a different way. But an economy, in order to stay viable, has to be constantly bringing new technology into it, if it's going to be an industrial economy. Now, there have been examples of economies that have stayed in the same place for centuries. Those have been agrarian economies. They were not industrial economies, and that's a whole different ballgame. Those were economies where using gold and silver had always been an adequate currency. That doesn't work so well in an industrial economy. Yeah.
Is the sun a cornerstone of the growth economy and constantly reducing the population? I mean, nobody wants to talk about that, but it seems to me the growth economy is basically increasing. Assuming the population is increasing the population, and nobody wants to talk about
Well, yeah, really it could be said that the whole purpose of an economy is to provide constantly more efficient ways to support a population. It's an economy that allows greater population to exist. One thing to understand about economies is that they're constantly transforming the way in which we survive. And this, you know, there was an economist in the 1600s, I believe it was 1600s, named Thomas Malthus, that brought forth this theory that population was always going to increase exponentially, and the amount of food that we could grow was always going to increase arithmetically. In other words, there was a limit to the land, and there was no limit to the increase in population. And there have been periodically, every 30, 40 years since the 1600s, economists, theorists have come forth to say, we've reached our limit. And then something else happens, and the whole system gets turned upside down, and then we're set, you know, for another runaround. So the population issue really can't be taken to the level of, say, food supply. I mean, realistically, if we had to, we could build skyscrapers and grow food hydroponically. We have the technology to do that, and other resources as well. I mean, even the way that we manufacture things, that's constantly being transformed.
Disease increases with some of those technologies, so those are actual solutions.
Yeah, it's true. Those technologies introduce other problems.
And
yeah.
It's distribution and density of both population as well.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but one of the things that I've come across in my research is that population density is not a bad thing. That's kind of the conclusion I've come to. In fact,